everybody. This is Jim Van Beber, and I'm right here in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
1, 2, 3, 4! Almost every day, I see the same face. A broken picture too, if it's the attitude. If you can see yourself, we put you on a shelf. Your verbal masturbate, problems to nauseate. Today I play the part of the parent. Now make all the rules for you to know about yourself. The lies make you believe what's evil. It's making love and making friends and meaning got the wrong way. The right way to see, to bleed, cannot be done. In turn, you're making us fucking lost.
Welcome to another fucking episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White, and with me, as always, is Mondo Justin, a.k.a. Bastard Son of Bone Crusher.
Hello, fuckers.
This week, we're doing another fucking little different show here, in that we're including a guest host this week. Our fucking first, in fact, and please welcome Jason Buchanan from All Movie Guide to the show. Please say hello, you fucker.
Fuck yeah, thanks for having me. Love Debbie to Dawn, thanks.
Thanks for coming to the show, fuckface.
So getting right to it, Justin, this was your pick this week, so why don't you tell everyone just why you picked this fucking movie?
Well, it's a good fucking question. So this week I went genre and selected the 1988 film Deadbeat at Dawn. The film was directed by the one and only Jim Van Beber. Now, Van Beber not only directed this debut feature film here, but he also fucking wrote it, edited it, was the fucking stunt and fight coordinator, and he also stars in the fucker as Goose, the leader of the badass gang of thugs in mid-80s Dayton, Ohio. Now, for anyone that hasn't seen Deadbeat at Dawn, it's about two rival gangs that are fighting each other. Van Beber's character, after a big brawl in which he gets cut up really bad, promises his girlfriend that he'll leave the gang in order to maintain their relationship. So he leaves the gang to pursue a different life. However, once his former enemies hear about this, they go after him, only to discover he's gone to do one last deal for big money, and they attack, disemboweling and cutting the hell out of his girlfriend Tracy. Now, Beber as Goose grieves the loss for about a reel or two, Mike, and then he joins back into the gang, biding time. To do one big bank heist, he attacks and takes out the entire gang that killed his girlfriend in 10 minutes, in which the final 10 minutes by the film of this fucker will destroy your fucking mind, because they're so over the top and genius.
Wow, I don't know what to say. I'm a little surprised that you chose to summarize it this week.
I'm just feeling really fucking confident today, you know? I'm feeling like a little badass.
Oh yeah? And why is that?
Because it's Deadbeat at fucking Dawn, and it's a badass film.
So Jason, I'm curious to know what you thought of the film.
It is a fucking badass film. I think my favorite thing about Deadbeat at Dawn is its weird mix of griminess and hallucinogenic with that just brutality that Van Beber does really well. It all seems so, Dayton is a great city. It's all so kind of post-apocalyptic almost in a way. Yeah, great characters too. Just great over-the-top acting, great editing, action. It's a really fun film to watch.
Yeah, I had no idea that Dayton was so dangerous until I watched that. I thought Dayton just sounded like a nice little town, but then you watch that film and it's just like, oh shit, I'm never going to Dayton.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
It's almost as bad as like Cincinnati.
The thing is it's almost like it almost looks like it could be shot in Detroit on so many levels. And then also what I find interesting about it too is all the adult things that are happening in the background. There's adult bookstores, adult movie theaters. It's like, man, I want to move to fucking Dayton.
Yeah, it's totally, it looks like a shot down 8 Mile or something. Yeah, it's very nice.
So Mike, I know that this week the film I chose was, you know, You had not seen the film prior to us picking on the show, right? So what were your initial first thoughts of the film?
Well, initially, I'll admit that, you know, you gave me two DVDs, two Van Beber DVDs. You gave me Manson Family and Deadbeat at Dawn. And I popped in Manson Family at first, and I was watching that, and I was like, oh, shit, this is awesome. And then I watched that through, then I popped in Deadbeat at Dawn, and I was just like, wow, this is really rough around the edges. And I thought for sure we were going to be talking about the Manson family. So I made all these notes about the Manson family and shit. And then you said, no, we're doing Deadbeat at Dawn. I was like, oh, okay. I mean, yeah, it's really rough around the edges. Definitely rough. And, you know, hearing the history of the film, I can understand why it was so rough, that, you know, that it was made over such a long period of time. But yeah, it was it definitely seems like a labor of love. Let's say that.
You son of a bitch.
What?
Is this going to turn into another Free Enterprise episode?
No. I'm not going to bash on the film. It wasn't. I can understand. You probably saw this years and years ago. Really enjoyed it. But me coming to it, so many years later and seeing it for the first time, I was like, wow, this is, really good, young filmmaker, very ambitious kind of stuff. I guess it would be like, if you picked up Evil Dead for the first time and you watched it and you'd be like, man, that's really kind of rough and shoddy and stuff. A couple places here and there, it's, maybe not the best film ever made. But if you watch that as a younger person and as an aspiring filmmaker, it's just like, oh shit, this is great. So coming to Deadbeat at Dawn later on in life, it's like, okay, yeah, I can see where this is very inspirational and where this really put this guy Van Beber on the map. And then I think about all the times I remember, reading about him in like Film Threat and Film Threat Video Guide. And it's like, okay, no wonder this guy was getting so much press. And I don't know why I never saw Deadbeat at Dawn until now. There's no reason why I shouldn't have, but it was just one of those that I passed by and never got a chance to see. So I appreciate you bringing it to my attention.
Jason, can you chime in on this? Because it almost feels like we might need to beat up Mike today.
No. Yeah, I mean, I think his point about it being a labor of love is really good. I mean, you can see that with this and with Manson Family. I mean, they both took a lot of time to make, and he stood by, he stood his ground and did it the way he wanted to do them, which is great. I always looked at it as an inspiration, too, because he got this done in Dayton, Ohio. He didn't need to go to Hollywood for this. He didn't need to go anywhere for this. He had the vision and he followed through with it and he came up with something pretty strong and pretty incredible.
Right. It's funny that Mike mentions Evil Dead because, Van Beber was actually hugely influenced by that film. And what I find ballsy about this movie, I mean, it is ambitious, and what's so fucking ballsy about this is the fact that he did everything. Like, he was, the lo-fi Dayton, Ohio auteur. And he did all this on his own, and that's so ambitious. And the fact that he was going to college. He risked his whole college education on this one movie. Like, he took his student loan money and spent it on the film. How fucking, it takes balls to do that. And if you can't respect that, I just don't see how you can even be a fan of any film. Especially if you're a filmmaker, you're wanting to make films. The fact that he had the gall to do it, I don't think I would ever be able to do this.
No, it's a huge risk to take, and it was pretty awesome that he did that. And that's what you need to, people need to do. They need to take the risk. And especially back when this was made, there was like no market for these kind of films other than like VHS. I mean, that whole thing where he's like, I've read about him trying to sell the film and just how that worked out and, doing the test reel and stuff. Again, that's very, reminds me of The Evil Dead, where they shot like the Within the Woods kind of short. And in this case, Van Beber shot what would become the last bit of the movie. And then to do a fight film as your low budget independent movie, I mean, because those could go so bad so fast, because if you've got bad fight choreography, those kind of things, it's going to look really bad. But he did a good job at it. And it's kind of funny because those last, 25 minutes or so when he's just like kicking everyone's ass. No one stands in his way in this movie.
I was gonna say, just the shots in that scene, they're so dynamic. His use of zooms, his use of cutting, he's really got the editing down and just creates, that sense of every hit, feeling really brutal.
Yeah, the thing about the last few minutes of it is that's where I think The Evil Dead really stands out, because he's using, you have to catch him fast, but there's a lot of Dutch angles in there. He's zooming in people's faces really fast, Dutch angling. He's doing rapid fire editing, and that's, I think, the ending is the payoff of the film. I mean, there's a lot of good moments in the front, but the ending is a total payoff. It's where, his influence of Bruce Lee comes into play in a major level.
And I have to admit, I love the clunky acting that's in the movie. I mean, just like some of Bone Crusher's lines and stuff, and just, the overuse of the F-bombs just exploding left and right, and it's just so, I don't know, it's very enjoyable.
I believe the word you're looking for instead of F-bomb is fucker.
Fuck, 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 fuck.
Fuck, 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 fuck.
What the fuck's going on there?
God,
wait, Mickey.
Sir, would you like to leave
the
town?
Give me the money! Look, it's a robbery!
Give me your gun, Grandma!
So I guess, you know, before we get in too depth into this conversation, I think, you know, so we don't run out of time, I think we should get into the interview that Mike and I did a few weeks back with Jim Van Beber.
All right, let's roll it.
I think anyone that, you know, is a fan of the film knows the story of, like, you know, how it came to be, the whole story about, like, how you went to New York, you know, with the 40 minutes of footage and all that. And, you know, I think it's also pretty well known that, you know, you took your, like, your student loan money to do that. I mean, that was really gutsy, don't you think? And I wanted to see, like, you know, if you had the same opportunity now, would you have made that same decision? You mean turning up, a year of college?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, it was the right thing to do. I by the second year of film school at Wright State, I realized that I wasn't interested in getting a degree in the motion picture program. The motion picture program at that point at Wright State was basically theory oriented. I just, you know, I knew in my heart that, you know, you could spend this money and end up with a degree, you know, a bachelor's degree, and you know, and still have nothing more, you know, to show for it than, you know, shorts that are dictated by professors who don't have as much vision or maybe talent than you do. And wanted out of film school is what I got, which was at first learning sound and then sound Super 8 and then the mechanics of 16 millimeter. So once I had that knowledge, and I met, you know, some guys that were, I could tell, inspired as I was, say, Raimi and Tappert and Campbell with The Evil Dead. You know, we were like, let's give this a shot. And so, you know, I knew it was going to be my film. I was going to direct it, so I was willing to, you know, step outside the box and, you know, take the risk.
You know, how much of an influence was, you know, Evil Dead on you in terms of the film?
Yeah, I loved Evil Dead. I had to go to a drive-in in Piqua, Ohio to see it, but it was at that time on a New Line, I guess, double bill with Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You know, I was just knocked out by it. I still am anytime I watch it. I think it's still easily Sam Raimi's most complete film. I mean, you can argue about the quality of the acting and, you know, the 16 millimeter, but it's got more heart and soul than certainly any of the sequels. It's hard to beat The Evil Dead still, you know, in my mind.
So is the title Deadbeat at Dawn, is there any subtle homage to The Evil Dead? I mean, where does the title of the film come from?
Because we really didn't have a title when we first started working on it. And Steve Bognar, one of the original guys who started doing the photography, and then he jumped off and Mike King jumped in. But Steve was he was a big Clash fan, and he had a book about the Clash. There was this one picture in the book that showed the members of the Clash, if I remember right, like outside of their tour bus, just all worn out and tired, and the caption, I believe, was Deadbeat at Dawn. And Steve was like, you should call it that. And I'm like, you're dead right. That's exactly it. It sort of just sums up the punk attitude, you know, that Deadbeat carried with it. Because Deadbeat, you know, was in a lot of ways a reaction to my love of action films from the 80s, the Chuck Norris, the Steven Seagal, you know, Stallone films, but with a punk ethic about it, you know, where the your hero, instead of fighting against people who sell drugs, he sells drugs. You know, he does drugs. You know, but it's still good. You know, it's a punk action film.
After everything's all said and done, I want to know, because I can't recall if you've ever said anything that I'm aware of, but what was the total budget after everything's all said and done?
Well, yeah, before deferments were paid and stuff, I think we came in somewhere around $200,000. But, you know, that's everybody killing themselves, and nobody's getting paid. And, you know, it's no way to make a movie, really. But, you know, movies are still being made that way. It's just, at least with us, you know, we're honest people and we do pay our back end, but, you know, a lot of people don't.
So, you know, going back to Deadbeat, you know, I really love the score of the film. I was wondering how that, you know, how was that? How did that whole thing come about? Like, did you set out to have a score originally, like rock music to be included?
Well,
or?
If I had my druthers, I would have really had a heavier, you know, Black Sabbath-y type score. But I just, at that point, you know, being young and, you know, really having no money, I had to work with what I had. And I knew this guy who was studying at Ohio State, who was a pretty talented musician. His name was Mike Perry. And he believed in the project. And, you know, we made a handshake deal where, you know, I could use music that he would compose for the film. And what he would get out of it was credit and having his music out there. But it was all basically, you know, the synthesizer. And by the time I'd cut it into the film, I realized, you know, with the action, I needed percussion. And so I knew a drummer for a local rock band. His name was Ned Folkert, and very talented guy. And so I just basically brought him into a studio at one point and, you know, set up the film and would play on a VHS tape with the sound down, key action parts, and have him improvise percussion, you know, and work with him on, you know, like, okay, now, you know, cymbals, and then, you know, okay, drum roll, and here for the last walk down the alley, I want a dirge, you know, beat, beat, beat. And so it's a combination, you know, of Ned Folkert and then Mike Perry, and he called his band A-OK, and so that's why it says, you know, music by A-OK and Ned Folkert.
So I want to talk about the visual style of the film. You're on 16 there, obviously, which, let me just tell you, is there nothing better than a film that's good on 16? Like, I always look at, you know, like your stuff, and then like look at Hennenlotter's Basket Case and how great those are in 16.
Sure, Last House on the Left, The Evil Dead.
Yeah.
You know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, on and on. I love 16 millimeter. I consciously, you know, me and Mike King chose the film stock of 7240 VNF video news film just to give it that, you know, drive-in look. I mean, that aesthetic. And yeah, that film is a reversal film. It's not negative. And so Mike had to be very careful with his f-stops. And it was a deliberate choice. And, you know, just the wardrobe and, you know, the psychedelic segues and all that. It's you know, meant to evoke, you know, late 60s, early 70s flavor.
Real quick on the visual style as well. Is there any influence there from like Kenneth Anger's work? Because, you know, I'm like really obsessed with those, the colors in the film. You know, I'm obsessed with that, like the saturated red and green combo you use. And mm-hmm. And I wanted to see if Anger's work was influenced on you. And also I noticed that, and I've noticed it before, but you know, in that scene where they're like in the basement with Danny and Bonecrusher, and they're basically unveiling the plot to take everyone down, in the background you see that little picture of James Dean on the wall. So I was wondering if that was like an homage to like Scorpio Rising or something.
No, not so much with Deadbeat. Certainly Anger's influence came in heavy on the Manson family, but it was, you know, it was part and parcel of the project. Probably a little bit on Deadbeat, but more, I don't know, you know, garish colors of Suspiria or Argento or Corman's The Trip. And the James Dean was just up there because I thought, well, Danny of the Spiders, if he's going to have a hero, who would it be? You know, it'd be freaking James Dean. So that was just a stupid personal choice. You know, it's no real Anger reference there. But like I said, Anger's influence is all over the place in the Manson family.
You know, earlier you mentioned the, you know, the influence of like the 80s action movies and late 70s action movies. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that, and to me, a little bit ahead of your time there, because, you know, I don't think a lot of people back then were actually looking at those as artistic. Do you know what I'm saying? And it just seems like now, over the last 3 or 4 years, people are now starting to look at the films of Chuck Norris and Seagal as and even like Dolph Lundgren as like artistic venture, you know, artistic films that need to be lauded. So, you know, I was wondering if you'd comment on that.
You know, it was more a reaction against those films. You know, certainly, I mean, I thought at that point, you know, that the action genre is a genre that should be respected. You know, I put it in as, you know, high a platform as, you know, the best drama or comedy or, you know, whatever. It's, to me, it's a legitimate genre. Sadly, you know, since, I don't know, since the start of the 90s, the concept of an action, you know, hero has disappeared, you know, and certainly after the advent of CGI, it's like you can't trust, you know, what you're watching, and, you know, all of a sudden you'll have a CGI Wesley Snipes leaping around in a wide shot of Blade or Blade 2 or, you know, Spider-Man. It's not even a stuntman, you know, it's a CGI figure, and, you know, CGI, I blame for, you know, the death of so much of what I love of cinema, of stuntmen and you know, risk-taking and squibs and, you know, blood packs. And
so I was wondering if we could talk a little about the story of the film. You know, I just wanted to see if it was viable to, you know, when you look at the center of everything, isn't it, in a sense, you know, isn't Debbie Dunn, isn't it, it's a love story to a certain extent, wouldn't you say? Like, it's also a revenge film, but there's a love story aspect there, I think, too, as well.
Absolutely. It's a classical kung fu revenge, you know, structure. But it's also, you know, it grows out of, like you said, you know, there's definitely a romance angle in there, and which dovetails at the end with the last line of the film. That's, you know, that's just me. It's like, you know, I knew that the character of Goose was an anti-hero. He is the, you know, he's just the least scummy of a bunch of scumbags. It's hard to really, you know, for an audience to get behind somebody unless there's, you know, something to latch onto. And, you know, people have accused me of, you know, being callous in the scene where Goose, you know, gets rid of Christie's body by putting it into a trash dumpster. And I'm like, well, no, I mean, they got no options. I mean, what's he going to do? You know, call the cops. He can't afford a funeral. You know, he's not going to, you know, he's burying her within the inner city, and, you know, it's killing him to do it. you know, but at the end of the day, it's a freaking action film, you know, I mean, you know, it's like, don't overanalyze it, you know.
Real quick, can we talk a little about the heroin junkie dad? I was curious to see if, you sure. know, was there any improv there? Or was that, you know, that rant, is it scripted?
It was scripted. I got to say, I had to rewrite it because it was originally written to be more of a sort of thin, feeble William Burroughs type of heroin addict. And, you know, I mean, we had very little money. You know, we were offering, you know, local actors. We held auditions, and we got, you know, guys who did dinner theater and commercials around Dayton, Ohio and Cincinnati to come in. And really, you know, none of them could act. The only guy who came in with any energy was Charlie Getz. And, but he was just so damn manic that I was like, okay, I want him, but there's no way he's going to pull off this William Burroughs type approach. So I wrote it, you know, rewrote it to be manic and, you know, still crazed about Vietnam and all this crap.
I told you to take my beer. This is my beer in my refrigerator. I don't remember inviting any pumpkin in here to drink my beer. That's my last beer. Oh, shit. What am I going to do? You've got my last fucking beer! What's the matter with you anyway? Now I ain't got no beer left. It's my last beer. I won't go on the street unless I get my gun. I'm gonna take my gun with me. You can't go out there without protection. You need protection. I'm gonna protect myself. there's anybody outside when you came in.
You know, Jim, I listened to an interview you did a while back where it was like an audio interview, actually, and you kind of said something that was really interesting to me in the sense that you kind of mentioned that you – maybe I didn't understand the point correctly, but almost to the point where you said that you got certain vibes from certain movies. So I was curious to see, because I actually experienced the same thing with your films in the sense that, like, when I watch your films, I really feel like something is wrong or like there's something dangerous here. You know, and I only get that from your work, and I get that from Kenneth Anger's work. Like, something is not right here. Something's very frightening. So I was wondering if you could talk about, like, you know, maybe about why, you know, why do people get certain, you know, vibes like that from films?
Well, I think a lot of it, I mean, if the director's in control of his work and there's an authorship to his work, I think it bleeds through. I mean, you watch the films of Sam Peckinpah, and except for like Convoy or Junior Bonner, I mean, there's a nihilism, a longing for lost ideals of, you know, when men were men or whatever. And, you know, it applies to his films. Scorsese had a vibe from, you know, Mean Streets through like Almost Casino. And then, you know, it disappeared. But, you know, Cronenberg certainly gave off a vibe with his films up into maybe he lost it right after Dead Ringers. I think it just, you know, it speaks from the filmmaker. And, you know, I like dark, depressing subject matter. I like, you know, dangerous cinema. I like to be challenged. I'm a big fan of, you know, downer, you know, endings and material. And so that perspective, I guess, just comes through in what I've done to this point. You know, it's like, you know, if I got hired as a gun for hire to make a, you know, a comedy, I'm sure that would even, you know, be kind of sick in its own way, you know. I think, like I said, a filmmaker who's in control of his work, I think his filmmaking sensibilities bleed through.
Nice, yeah. So I want real quick about the ending of the film and, you know, how you kind of it just pushes it like a, you know, a death-defying speed. And I think that was your initial, you know, intention all along, wasn't it? Just to pretty much like, you know, just that was like the ultimate showdown. Like, this is where you're going to pull out all the stops and just wow everyone.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I always think, you know, film should, you know, start out strong and then, you know, lull your audience and feed in a little bit of plot, and then, you know, you got to hit them over the head, you know, in the ending. I can't stand films that, like, you know, give their best shit out right off the bat. Like, chief example, I would say, would be Desperado. It's like the best part of that film to me is the opening bar shootout, and then there's nothing in that film, let alone the climax, that even comes close to that glory, you know. And so, you know, you got to save your best punches for the last round, you know. And it was, yeah, designed to, you know, it's all building up, you know. You just start stacking the set pieces, you know. It's like, okay, you have the armored car robbery, and then you try and up that with the chase of Goose by the car, and then, you know, all that's got to be blown away with the battle royale, you know, at the train station at the end. And then, you know, the ultimate, you know, being drug on the car, you know, down the alley, all that crap. You're composing a song or something, and you want the last, you know, delivery of Light My Fire, you know, you want Morrison to be screaming those lyrics at the end as opposed to singing them softly at the beginning, you know.
Right. And that's the most interesting thing about this, I think, is just what a bad motherfucker you are, in the sense that, like, you know, you did all these stunts yourself. And I mean, do you look back at this and be like, I cannot believe I did that shit?
Oh, no, not really. In fact, you know, before, I always say before I'm 55, but, you know, I've probably, when I'm 55, I'll want to do another action film, but I stay in shape and I train, and I'm certainly willing to do it again. It's just the next action film, I can't do another biker movie tribute. It's got to have more, I think, intelligence. But I certainly want to wow the audience with crazy set pieces, and I'm just as nuts as I ever was.
So do you have a biker film in you?
Well, I've got a script.
So is there any truth to the rumor I heard in an interview you did that you talked about a possibility maybe of a Deadbeat sequel?
That was kind of bandied about a little bit. I don't think I really took it too seriously. I think the biker action film that I'm talking about is sort of a continuation of the character of Goose, but only in the sense that, the High Plains Drifter is basically the man with no name. More or less the same character, different movies. I wouldn't do that because, Goose died once and for all at the end of Deadbeat, and that's just that. I mean, there's nobody survives, getting their guts knocked apart, and finger bit off and bleeding to death in the street.
What's going on with the documentary that was supposed to be in the works about, that followed you around?
Oh, Victor Bonacore's documentary. He's cutting it right now, and he's maybe still going to interview a few more folks, and I don't know. He should have it finished sometime in the fall. And it'll be a companion piece to, I licensed him the rights to a whole bunch of, 8mm films that I made from the age from 11 to 17. And, they're, real backyard.
I was going to ask you about those. Yeah, uh-huh. So those are coming out on the same DVD?
Yeah, so you'll have, my very, very early, regular 8mm films, and he's gotten various bands to put scores to those because they were all shot without sound. And then, he's going to have a feature-length documentary just talking to a lot of people that I've worked with or people, that wanted to talk about their reaction to my films.
Where are we sitting with Capone? Because last time I've actually exchanged messages with you for like the last year, and I heard the interview you gave, it was for Dead Pit Radio, and you kind of mentioned Capone, that you had like Michael Paré involved. And so,
we came very close with a company that I won't name, but we were, getting right down to the wire with it. It was very close to setting a starting date. Schedules were being drawn up. The budget was set. I was ready to go, and I was very excited. And then at the last minute, that company put their money into a sequel to another film. And that's all I'm going to say about it, because I don't want to sound like sour grapes or point fingers. But it really sort of took the wind out of me. And so I said, that was a big movie, and I still intend on making it because I think, I watched Boardwalk Empire, and they're just playing fast and loose with historical facts, and, they're not, the research doesn't seem to be there. And my film about Capone is meticulously researched, and it's nothing but the truth, and it would be to Al Capone what the Manson family was to Charles Manson and his story. And I think it's a story that nobody has told or gotten right. And, with my visceral approach, I think I could really breathe fresh life into it. And, I still want to make it. It's just finding the company to do it. But like I said, getting that jerked away, I took a step back and I thought, okay, well, I'm going to write something smaller with fewer characters and, a smaller budget to make it and less locations and more of a horror film thriller, and that's what I've done. It's called Scales, and all I can really let you know about it is that it's about a guy who wrestles alligators, and everything turns out very badly. For everybody.
Understand. They don't care.
We're waiting for our father to be set free. He's a genius. You don't realize.
And leave aside something witchy.
So are you a fan of the Gazzara Corman Capone?
It's got a lot to like, but it's got a lot to hate. It's not a really good film per se. You've got that. It's got, like I said, it's got its pros and cons. You've got Roger Corman's the St. Valentine's Day Massacre, which is pretty good for its time, except it's stiff, and Jason Robards, as good as he was, he's just physically totally wrong for Al Capone. The Rod Steiger version from the 60s is okay, but, I mean, it again gets the facts wrong. I mean, the ending of that movie would lead you to believe that Al Capone was beat to death by fellow inmates with, bricks. And that's certainly not what happened to Al Capone. And, The Untouchables is just a freaking mess. I mean, Robert De Niro is brilliant as Al Capone, but Frank Nitti certainly didn't die by being pushed off of a rooftop. He blew his own brains out. I mean, the real story, the real facts is certainly good enough. I don't know why somebody feels compelled to, disregard the truth when they're making something about a real life. You know, that's why I took such pains about the Manson family. I mean, the only thing I really, left out of the Manson family was the fact that Mary Brunner was at the Hinman place when Bobby and Sadie were there. But I left her out because she turned state's witness against Bobby and Susan Atkins, Sadie. And, she's free, and I didn't want a lawsuit from her. So, but other than that, I mean, it's dead on. I truth is stranger than fiction, and if you're going to write fiction, fine. Go for it, and God bless. But if you're dealing with a historical fact, I mean, do it justice, for crying out loud.
Ahoy, mateys. This is K.A.B., Antonio Bay. Stevie Wayne here, beaming a signal across the sea. I'll be here playing music all through the witching hour. I'm still waiting to hear from that weatherman. But in the meantime, stay here with me. Be sure to visit our sponsor, Paracinema Magazine. They're the source for all your genre movie needs. Check them out online at paracinema.net. Tell them Stevie sent you. Keep me turned on for a while, and I'll do my best to do the same for you.
The smooth sound. Fabulous 1340. KAB.
One of my favorite scenes is after their first big fight, and Van Beber tells his girlfriend he's going out, and he takes his nunchucks, and he just goes into the cemetery. He's like, he's practicing, and he stops at the end, and he looks out to the, over the city. He goes, fuck!
I was going to say, who I think a good gang for the Ravens to meet up with would be the Surf Nazis from Surf Nazis Must Die. Because I can see like Goose and Mengele kind of having like a little bit of a thing going on there. Or maybe Bone Crusher and Mengele would probably be better.
You know, one thing I really like about the film too, and it's not really talked about too much, is the supernatural theme that runs through the film, in the sense that you've got the people practicing or, you know, conjuring witchcraft things at the beginning, and then you got the black cat crossing the path, and you got the voodoo magic necklace, and then even when Bone Crusher talks about when they killed, he says, you know, he's like, what did her insides look like? He's like, look like snakes, man, snakes. I really like the supernatural aspects of it. They're not even addressed. I think it's brilliant. Jason?
Well, he seems to imply that it's real too. I mean, you know, when she does the Ouija board, it says she's gonna die today. So, you know, there is that underlying, you know, angle of it through the whole thing, that supernatural stuff, it might have been real.
Yeah, which is a real bummer when you finally use the Ouija board. It's just like, it's like going to the Chinese restaurant and you get that fortune. It's like, oh, really? Come on. All right. Well, I'm not leaving a tip.
All right. So, you know, I don't mind talking a little bit about the Manson family since, you know, we've got the time. So do you guys think that the Manson family is a better film than Debbie to Dawn?
I liked it a little bit better, I guess, just because it was a little, I won't say because it was more polished, but I'll say I really liked the experimental stuff that he was doing in there, and the color. Oh, my God. The color saturation in that movie just is, you know, I wanted to go up and lick the screen. It was really just tasty.
Did you?
No, I did not. No, the screen was too dusty. Sorry.
But the thing is you see those saturated colors in Debbie to Dawn as well. There's a lot of usage of green and reds, and those are what actually remind me, for whatever reason, of Kenneth Anger, because Anger's always using those colors in like Scorpio Rising and, you know, the oversaturation of the pink and Custom Car Commandos. And so I know there's, you know, no connection there whatsoever, but I still really appreciate it. And I think it's, you know, I'm a visual person, and so I really respond to the visuals of this movie tremendously. You know, I can, you know, forget about the story when I'm watching this, because I'll be so wowed by the visuals of this movie. And I really think, you know, to Jim Van Bever's credit, that is brilliantly directed, and the coloring is amazing. The camera is amazing. You know, I really think it's a great film, and I really think between this and Free Enterprise, you should really think about, make a second opinion on Free Enterprise and this film.
Oh, jeez. You know, for every strip teaser you give me a Free Enterprise. So, no, that's not true. You need to stick more to the strip club massacre films, I suppose, than the Geeks on the Loose. But no, I don't. You are talking to me as if I disliked this film, and I did not dislike this film. I liked Manson Family a lot, and I can see where this was where Deadbeat at Dawn was a stepping off point for him. And I think it was a great first effort. You know, I mean, it's right up there with some of the filmmakers that we were talking about earlier. You know, it's right up there with like El Mariachi, you know, so.
Kenneth and Jay.
And yeah, all the Kenneth Anger from
Jason comments.
You can definitely see a progression. That's from, you know, him evolving and everything from Deadbeat to Manson Family, you know, and the Manson Family is going for something really specific, trying to recreate the look, you know, the old footage you see of the Manson Family on the ranch and stuff. And he just gets it so well that it's easy to get lost in the movie.
Yeah, I would love to see that on the big screen as well. I mean, I can't imagine what that would be like.
It's a powerful movie to see in the theater.
Oh, you saw it in the theater?
Yes, I saw when it played in Royal Oak. Went to see it there twice.
Why do we not know about these screenings?
I don't know. We need to hang out with Jason a little bit more. I mean, he saw Freaked in the theater, so.
Hey. I don't understand how I'm missing these screenings. You'll be sorry when I set up my Jerry Lewis screenings, bitch.
Well, apparently you don't read enough Real Detroit, so.
I guess not, yeah. Well, at first they don't offer Real Detroit when we're like, so. They have the coffee news thing, a little folder, that little black and brown thing that comes out.
Oh, like the
coffee talk.
Oh, nice.
The single-sided pamphlet. Right.
Do they have the placemats where it's like, yo, come out and get free hair removal and all that?
So you want to add anything?
You know, I just love the kaleidoscopic effects that he uses, you know, especially at the end when he's really tripping out, when he's just decided to fucking, you know, overdose or do whatever right before he gets taken back into the gang. And the bar scene. And right after that, in the hallway with the other junkie, so good. And just that's when it gets really dark and really grim. And you can feel that he definitely has something invested in this, wanting to make it as fucked up and gritty and grimy as possible. And yeah, I like how he's just so reckless at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't.
we're gonna have a Justin soundboard where it just says yeah.
And I liked one of the things that I liked. I noticed I made a note of. I love when he first quits the gang, and when you know he gets into the scuffle with the other guy, and he tells him, "Fuck you guys, I'm leaving." And he turns around and starts riding off on his motorcycle. And I don't know if it's just by chance or if he actually planned this, but you just see spray painted on the wall as he's riding off, "You suck," like a last fuck you to his old gang, you know. And it's perfect, you know. I don't know if that's just the city being a great character in the movie again, you know, or if it's something planned. But either way, it works so well. There's all those little touches like that.
Yeah, the city is definitely a character in the film, and it actually, you know, nothing can look worse than Detroit. But the you know, there is a weird, it's almost like the city is apocalyptic to a certain point, because you don't see. You only see one cop in the whole movie. So it's like the whole time you're watching, like, where are the cops?
Well, when you see his dad later on, his dad is like a scared, cornered animal in this apartment. And he, you know, he says, like, that would mean going outside, you know? And you know, going outside, the minute you step outside, something fucked up is going to happen in that city.
You know, when we're comparing characters to animals, the projection booth is getting too arty.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We say dick and fart jokes here.
Purple Vein dick joke coming up.
What, Bone Crusher?
Give me that rush. Man, that ain't nothing compared to the rush you can get when you're killing somebody, man. You know what I mean? When you're looking in their eyes and you're seeing all that life just go right out of them, it's power. I hate people, man. I don't care. I don't give a shit. I don't give a shit about nothing. Man. All my life, people have fucked with me. Don't you fuck with me, man. I just fucking hate people. I hate people. And I don't care! I just don't fucking care. I don't care. No, I am the baddest motherfucker you ever saw, man!
All Detroit has a cancer. The cancer is crime.
We need a self-sufficient law enforcement robot.
How long will it take?
We can go to prototype within 90 days.
Where are you from?
Metro South.
Welcome to hell.
All units, sector 9.
Dead or alive, you're coming with me.
Really good.
Half machine.
RoboCop. What is he?
He's a cyborg, you idiot.
All hero.
What are your prime directives?
Protect the innocent.
Let the woman go,
or there will be trouble.
Uphold the law.
You are under arrest.
What is this shit?
Justice gets an upgrade.
Looking for me?
Move, creep. RoboCop.
Thank you for your cooperation. Good night.
That was audio from the trailer for next week's pick, mine, the 1987 film RoboCop. Next week we'll be covering the film as well as speaking to a whole plethora of people, including Nancy Allen, Miguel Ferrer, Ronnie Cox, Ed Neumeier, Michael Miner, Ed Naha, Monty Hellman. It's just going to be chock full of good stuff.
Fuck, that is a lot of people. I will definitely buy that for $1, and that's unscripted.
God, how many times are we going to hear that next week?
As many as it takes, baby.
All right, so any final thoughts on the film, guys? Or should we just... put this one to bed.
Jason?
I can't wait to see what he's going to do next. Not necessarily a film so far, but I'm looking forward to some more nude Jim Van Bever.
Did you say
nude Van Bever?
Yeah, well, you get that in the Manson family, you know? A couple of nice sausage shots.
Yeah, he does have a nice ass, I will say. You see his ass in W to Dawn. It is kind of nice.
Stay in shape. Could bounce a quarter off that ass.
That's right. As Lewis and Revenge of the Nerds say, how can you have enough of that ass, Takashi? Number three!
You mean two.
Okay, so, you know, before we go, I wanted to ask you, Mike, you know, where you'll be this week with your book and what do you have going on?
Yes, that's right. I am not in my basement right now. I am actually out on the road in Brooklyn, New York today. Tonight, there is a screening of Black Shampoo at the Rerun Gastro Pub here in Brooklyn. That's going to be, I think, at 7 o'clock. $5 gets you in to see me and Black Shampoo. I don't think you could find a better bargain than that. Friday night at the Coolidge Corner Theater in Boston, I'll be there showing Black Shampoo. That's right. And the next night, Saturday, at the Cable Car Cinema, Black Shampoo again. So if you're into seeing Black Shampoo and Mike White, come on out. We should call it the Black and White Tour, the Black Shampoo Mike White thing. So yeah, lots of Black Shampoo and lots of me, probably too much. So that's what I have going on tonight and this weekend.
I'm just wondering if Graydon is getting any residuals from all these screenings of Black Shampoo.
No, luckily he gave me pretty much carte blanche to show this thing. So it's kind of nice. And hopefully he's getting traction through his website, GraydonClark.com.
Yeah, but I mean, if he's giving you so much carte blanche, like, can you just change Black Shampoo to be directed by Mike White?
Hey, I'm no Quentin Tarantino, dude.
Hi, this is Michael Beck, and I'm in the projection booth with Mike and Justin.
So that concludes another Golden Cobb-nominated episode of the Projection Booth. I'd like to thank our first guest host, Jason Buchanan, for coming onto the show.
Thank you.
Mad a few words. Special thanks goes out to the amazing Jim Van Bever for doing the interview with us for the show. We really appreciate you and your amazing work. So in case you haven't noticed, we said the word fuck a lot in this week's show. We did this in honor of the amount the word is used in the film Dead Beat It Done. This episode is also the first show where we'll give away a prize for whomever can email us with the correct number count of the word fuck in this week's show. The winner will receive a new copy of the DVD, The Almighty Thor.
So that's the movie Thor that's out in theaters right now, correct?
No, Mike. This is the amazing Richard Grieco film from Asylum Entertainment.
Oh, nice.
Right. The winner will receive a new copy of the DVD. And so listen again and guess the number of jelly beans or count the word fuck in the show and email us. And you could be the lucky winner of a fabulous DVD.
Woo-hoo!
So we'll leave you this week. We're going to rock your socks off with some Slayer. It's a cover of the 1969 18-minute Iron Butterfly opus in Encanto de Vida. This take on the psychedelic jam comes from the soundtrack for the 1986 film Less Than Zero. Slayer knocks his sucker out in under 4 minutes, and they don't skip much. Flash devil horns, guys.
I'm flashing them. I'm flashing them. I am so metal right now.
No scripting.